WBEN, Buffalo, New York.
1948, the fourth year of the existence of Arthur Godfrey Time. And here today to help get this show off is the celebrated Metropolitan Baritone William Walker. Bill Walker has come all the way back from Mississippi, where he is doing a concert for what benefit?
The Mississippi Arts Festival, it's called.
At Jackson?
At Jackson, Arthur, yeah. Mm.
And he came up just to be with us for one day and then turn around and go right back.
Well, I think it's a privilege to be asked to be here.
Oh, man, we are so happy to see you.
I'm here from the Minnesota Fats Festival myself.
Well, that was nice of you to come, too.
Right on cue.
Yes. And I have all kinds of things for you today. I did an interview with Bill Ruckelshaus and John Biardi yesterday, which I'm going to divide up into three pieces, one of which I want you to listen to today. But first of all, let's get Richard to open the show for us with a vocal selection from the year 48.
Okay.
It only happened when I dance with you. That trip to heaven till the dance is through. With no one else do the heavens seem quite so near. Why does it happen, dear, only with you? Two cheeks together can be so divine, but only when those cheeks are yours and mine. I've danced with dozens of others the whole night through, but the thrill that comes with spring, when anything could happen, that only happens with you. I've danced with dozens of others the whole night through, but the thrill that comes with spring, when anything could happen, that only happens with you.
That's nice, Dick. Thank you. 1948. What the heck was it from? A play or something?
Oh, it's from a movie called Easter Parade, where they took a whole bunch of Irving Berlin songs, including the title tune, Easter Parade. And it had a lot of people.
48, that was the year?
Yeah.
For heaven's sake.
He didn't write Easter Parade. There's just a lot of the old good ones and a few new songs.
Oh. Bill, Dick, I got something to show you you won't believe. As you know, I'm very keenly interested in livestock, especially horses and cattle, beef cattle. And one of the things we've been looking for is a beef cow of a beef cattle breed that will also give a lot of milk so we can raise a big calf, you know. And so we've been seeking all kinds of crosses to try to develop this thing. And just recently, my friends Art Palmer of St. Paul, Minnesota, and Jim Bishop have procured some South Devon cattle, which they brought over here. Just the other day, I was treated to the exercise of rubbing the back of a 3,300-pound bull.
Wow.
And you cross that feller on some white-faced Herefords or something, and you come up with a cow that will weigh about 1,000 pounds when she's weaned and develops a terrific udder and thereafter can feed some calves and bring them way up, see? And I thought we were doing very well when along comes a letter from Colonel T.M. Nesbitt, Jr., a member of the Isaac Walton League, one of the sparkling members of the Isaac Walton League in Birmingham, Alabama, who sent me a can of stuff. Please ask somebody to go get that can. I've got to show it to Dick and Bill and the boys. But among other things, Bill, he sent me a picture of a cow. Looks like a Jersey, which I want you to see. I don't think you've ever seen a cow like this in your life, and you come from the cattle country, too. I never saw anything like that. A pair of twin udders.
Absolutely.
She is utterly out of this world. She has one set aft and one set forward.
Of what?
Those are udders.
Tell the difference, Arthur.
He can't. I see. Yeah. Isn't that amazing? She's got an udder between her forelegs and an udder between her hind legs.
Incorrect.
And you talk about a milker, man. That's something. I want to cross her on one of Aunt Parma's.
An eight stopper nipple. Knocker thing.
Would that be something, huh? I'm sure that. That my friend Nesbitt has been fooling around with the camera some way to get that.
That's incredible.
Gosh, would that be something? Two sets of fountains on one cow, huh?
Two sets in the fountain. Arthur, I did see. I met a guy on an airplane the other day out in Montana that was up buying some cattle and some crossbreeds and so forth. And I did think about you and your interest in cattle and so forth. A man lives south of Kansas City. And he breeds Simmentals. Do you know that breed?
No. How do you spell that?
S-I-M-M-O-N-T-A-L.
No.
Simmental.
That one I hadn't heard.
It's a Swiss cow, and it's a heavy cow, and has lots of beef quality, and produces a tremendous amount of milk.
Hey, that sounds great.
And besides that, they're pretty. Uh-huh. As far as cows go, I guess.
Well, yeah.
You know.
You know, there was Mrs. O'Brien, wasn't it? She kissed O'Grady, was it, in Chicago?
Mrs. O'Brien's cow kicked over the lantern that burned Chicago.
Oh, yeah, that's what it was, yeah. Different story. But anyway, Simmental, huh?
Simmental.
Simmental.
Yeah, they've just been to Switzerland. They're nice cowboy people.
See what he sent me? Isn't that a gorgeous thing? You spray this around the room, and it repels all the BS.
We need a lifetime supply of that where I live, I think.
BS, that stands for broadcasting system, folks, in case you didn't know. It says, directions, when BS is detected, aim atomizer at source and spray for 1 second. So you go, psst, like that.
See you later.
You just made Richard disappear.
You just killed my whole act, you know?
Hey, it smells pretty good, too. Hey, a BS repellent. I think that's lovely. He said, be careful with it. I'm running short. Says I had to get a whole supply of it for the moon. He goes for those moon rides like I do. We really need this last load of rocks he brought. But anyway, this is the date that the Free State of Israel was proclaimed in Tel Aviv. May the 14th in 1948. This would be the, 15th birthday? 48 to 72.
48
to 72. How
long? 12 is what?
24
years.
24th year, yeah. 20, next year would be the 25th, yeah. 24. What else happened on this day? Oh, yeah. Berlin was blockaded by the Soviet, refusing to permit U.S. and British supply trains to pass through the Soviet zone of Germany. Oh, my. I can remember one night sitting down with George Kinney, who was then General MacArthur's chief of air, asking me to... He's trying to get me to work with him to help get General MacArthur elected president. Because what he's going to do is... He and General MacArthur were going to get into a B-29 they had by that time, yeah. And they were going to fly into Moscow and say, Joe, we don't like this curtain you got. Raise it up. Now, either you raise it up, or in 24 hours, we're going to blast you off the face of the earth. And he says, you know, of course, what they'll do. They'll raise it up, because they have no defense for this now. But nobody ever did anything about it, and so here we are today with the fence still up there in Berlin, huh?
Absolutely. Not only there, but everywhere else, too.
Yeah. Everything was... It could have been done, you know. It might have been. Of course, all this hindsight is great. This was the year they discovered fluoride. Dr. Basil B. Bibby discovered it for dentistry, fluoride solution. It's supposed to help your teeth.
Basil B. Bibby?
And Basil B. Bibby, yeah.
Oh, that's a great name for a dentist.
And vitamin B12 was discovered by Dr. Mary S. Shorb. We didn't know about B12 before 48? Well, for heaven's sakes.
Is that the energy vitamin?
It's supposed to be, but I take it by the bucket and it gives me none, so...
That's the high C vitamin for the tenors at the Opera House. They had a famous tenor that was very famous right at that time, and his wife used to give him those injections of B12 just before he went out on the stage, and he was caught in the process one night by one of his colleagues, and they said, I understand that you didn't use that B12 stuff. It must have been a real fad when it first came out.
Oh, yes.
He says, well, I don't. Says, well, what was your wife doing with that syringe giving you that shot? He says, well, I don't really need it. God gave me all the high C's I need, but unfortunately, I think science helped him along a little, too.
I want you to sing one for us, if you will, Bill. Then I got a story to tell you about a wonderful doctor in our town here in New York who is... the favorite of all the opera stars, who takes care of the throats of lots of us in show business, too. And I go to him when I have this gosh-awful bronchitis, which I have now. And he's helped me today, and I went to see him today. And after you finish your song, I'm going to tell you a cute story about
it.
Don't let me forget. This is Bill Walker of the Metropolitan Opera.
And we're going to sing something from 1948.
You got a tune from 48?
Yes, sir.
Oh, that's great.
I want to be in line with what everybody's doing here.
Good boy. Wow. Bill Walker. I couldn't do that if my life depended on it.
How about a shot of vitamin B12?
Well, I went to my dear friend Herr Doctor today. He's a naturalized German and a genius with throats and so forth. And many, many, many of us in show business go to him. His walls are plastered with pictures of grateful stars whom he has helped. And he was telling me the story of this shot that he was giving me in my backside here. I said, look, it's my throat. He said, yeah, I know. And he hit me with this stuff, and he said, now, don't go near any girls for 24 hours. I said, oh, why? He said, because your breath will be horrible. I said, why? He said, well, it goes into your blood and into your lungs and helps clear your lungs out. But the smell is awful for about 24 hours. He said, once The girl who relieved Mary Martin in South Pacific came to me in dire distress, and I gave her one of these shots and said to her, "Now, be very careful. I don't know whether you're going to... you better warn your partner tonight who took Pinza's place." See? And she said, "Why?" He said, "Because your breath's going to be pretty bad." And she said, "Good, at last I'm going to get even with him."
Good.
She said, "He insists on eating a lot of Italian food full of garlic, and every night I have to put up with it." She said, "You mean tonight I'm going to get even with him? That's great." And the doctor said, "You know, it's so funny. I pay a lot of money, and I sit there in the orchestra, and I look and think, there he goes into your arms, and I would love to be there, too. And one of you stinks of garlic and the other of this medicine. It must be charming."
Well, you know, we have a lot of garlic at the opera house, too. There's a story, Arthur, there's a story of one of the Fiennes' girlfriends at the opera before he went to the South Pacific called him and asked him for tickets when the show was so hot that nobody could get tickets for it at all. And he said, "Of course, my dear, I'll be delighted. All the pleasure you have given me in my life, I'll be delighted to give you some." So she got the tickets for the show and so forth. And she mentioned in passing that Mary Martin had complained that he was so amorous on stage that he didn't fake anything. He grabbed her and kissed her and just wrung her out like a dish rag. And so his friend in the opera said to him, says, "Ezio, I understand that... your leading lady is receiving all of your amorous attention." And he said, "Tonight, my dear, since you are going to be there, I shall swallow her."
Well, now I have something serious for you. As you know, I'm dedicated the rest of my life to the study of ecology and passing on that which I can find out to you in the hope that we can do something in time to save the something of our planet for our progeny. And so yesterday, I was honored to have here in the studio two gentlemen, and I taped an interview with them, which I'm dividing into three parts, a third of it for today, and I think I introduce it, don't I, Jimmy? So take it right from here. Put the tape. Here with me today in the studio is the Honorable William Ruckelshaus, who is administrator of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. Did I say that
right? That's right. You said it just right.
And Dr. John Biardi, John C. Biardi, who is chairman of the New York Ocean Science Laboratory, of whose board of trustees I am privileged to be a member. I tried to get these two gentlemen together so that they could meet and get to know each other because their interests are identical. John Biardi, with his laboratory out there, is really a consortium, isn't it, John, of universities?
Yes, it is. There are eight universities involved in this organization. It's a separate corporation, nevertheless, but eight institutions in the greater New York area have come together to establish a laboratory dedicated to the pursuit of the solutions to problems of the waters around Long Island, the New York Bight, and, of course, hopefully, what we find can be useful elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. And Bill Ruckelshaus, who directs the ever-growing EPA, gosh, did you think when you first started, Bill, it would get as huge as it is?
No, I did not. We've grown from... when we started, about 6,000 people to now 9,000, and a budget of $1.3 billion when we started about 15 months ago, now to $2.5 billion. So it's growing.
Now, the EPA sets standards for pollution or for water purity. How do you do that?
We have varying ways of doing it. In water, we set with the states water quality standards, which include three things. A water quality use designation. 90% of the waters in the country are designated for the highest and best available use, which would be swimming and full body contact. We then set criteria that are necessary in order to achieve that use. What are the dissolved oxygen levels? What levels of suspended solids? All kinds of criteria of pollution that will maintain, or purity, actually, that would maintain the best use designated. The third element in any water quality standard is an implementation plan in which each discharger into a particular water body is put on a schedule of abatement. In air, we set ambient air quality standards for, we've now set them for the six major air pollutants in the country. And those standards are primary standards to protect the public health and secondary standards to protect against all known or anticipated adverse effects from air pollution.
Mm-hmm. Now, what I'd like to know is, who is it who sets these standards? Boards of science? Scientists?
Well, under the statute, it's me, but I set them by... We in air, let's take one air pollutant, sulfur oxides, which is a pollutant here in New York, and comes primarily from the burning of high sulfur content fossil fuels. We have what's called an air quality criteria document, which assembles all of the scientific studies and evidence that has been done relating to the health impact of sulfur oxides. Some of these studies are done by our own scientists, some are done by outside institutions, outside our agency or even state agencies. We then, from all of that information, arrive at a number that is permissible for the amount of sulfur oxides in the air to protect the public health. And that is the primary standard. That standard will then be announced or proposed as a national standard, and there will be 90 days for the public to comment, for people to complain that it's too stringent or it's too lenient. And we get a lot of complaints whenever we announce one of these standards. We then take all those complaints or those comments into account and announce our final standard.
The complexity of the problem. Holy smokes.
It is.
Most everybody who manufactures anything is going to be involved in this thing, and
that's
each
right.
is going to have his own complaint, and you have to listen to it and take it into consideration. And when you come up with an answer, is it... the same way you do with water, depending on what you're going to do it with? No. Ambient air
different.
Is everywhere.
That's different.
Yeah.
That's right. In the air, it's to protect the public health to the extent we know what impact these pollutants have on the public health. There's a lot of gaps in our knowledge. And the secondary standard is to protect the environment in general or the public welfare and against all known or anticipated effects, adverse effects of air pollution. And as you might imagine, like in any area of this, in scientific area, there's tremendous dispute among the scientists themselves.
Yes.
One will say that's just as crazy, you've got it too strict, and others say you ought to have it much stricter. And you just have to try to weigh all the competing claims and come up with a standard that is going to protect the public health and what it's supposed to do, and at the same time is as wise as you can possibly come up with.
Mm-hmm. This SO2 that you're speaking of, sulfur dioxide, it's true, is it not, that when one breathes that, it mixes with the H2O in his lung, the water, and makes sulfuric acid, right?
Yes, that is one of the effects. Sulfur oxides are a clearly hazardous pollutant. And one of the things we don't know very much about is what happens when sulfur oxide is combined with other pollutants in the air. You usually find sulfur oxides in combination with particulates or smoke. And it's the synergistic effect, or the combination of these two pollutants that you breathe into your lungs that can really give you problems. But there's a lot of gaps in our knowledge. We don't know exactly what happens.
Let me ask this, Bill, and then I want to ask John a question, please. Do scrubbers, so-called scrubbers on smokestacks, have any appreciable effect?
Yes, they do have an appreciable effect. There are many who claim they're not adequately demonstrated as yet, and we're on the frontier of demonstrating wet scrubbers to remove sulfur oxides. The main dispute now centers around two areas. How do we make sure that they are operational during the period in which they need to be? There are still enough technical difficulties that they break down all the time. And the second area is what percentage of the sulfur oxides do they remove? Everybody agrees they remove an appreciable percentage, but the range in claims is from 50% to 90%. And that can be very important in setting an ambient air quality standard and in allowing somebody to start up, say, a power plant. It's important to know just what percentage of the sulfur oxides we can get out in order to make sure they don't violate the standard.
John Biardi, I have been told and I read it somewhere, I'm sure I did, that there is a point off of Sandy Hook where New York City's been dumping sludge for many years. Is that about right?
There are
10 miles off?
Yeah, about 10 miles off. There's been some ocean dumping out there.
For many years?
Yes.
And I read somewhere that only last summer, I don't know whether it was your outfit or another, took tests in that water over a radius of some miles. I think they said 10 miles. And they could find no living organisms whatever. Is there any truth to that?
Well, in the immediate vicinity where the dumping has taken place, it's been reported that there's a lack of life. The concept...
Of any kind?
Correct. The concept has been that they call this the Dead Sea region. Of course, because of tide action, et cetera, much of this material is also now washing toward the city. So that the area of concern is widening. And there's much question about the continuation of ocean dumping and ways in which we can control this type of deposition of waste.
New York City is not dumping garbage, per se, is it? It's only sludge that goes out.
Sludge, as far as I know, yes.
They're putting the garbage, as I understand it, in what's called landfills, sanitary landfills in
or
Staten Island.
Or incinerating it.
Big pardon?
Or incinerating.
Are they incinerating it, too?
Some of the garbage is being incinerated.
That's nice air pollution, isn't it, Bill?
Can be. We have just set a new source emission standard for incinerators. Anybody building a new incinerator has to meet our new source emission standard, which, again, provides for the putting on of the latest and best available technology to reduce the pollutants from incinerator down to whatever levels are now possible. Even so, this, in a very badly polluted area, can... with the amount of pollution remaining that comes out, violate the ambient standard. So you can't always build one in every region.
I see. In case you tuned in late, that was a part of an interview I had and taped yesterday with Bill Ruckelshaus of the EPA and Dr. John Biardi, president of the New York Ocean Science Laboratory out at Montauk. And tomorrow I'll give you another segment of that because... I think you'll find it very interesting. He'll answer some questions that perhaps you've had in your minds. It's a frightening thing, that sludge thing out there, isn't it, huh? That's being swept now all the way up there to Jones Beach and beyond and down toward Asbury Park.
Right off.
A dead sea in the Atlantic Ocean right off of New York City.
And all life is gone.
Yes. No living organism in there. No plankton, no nothing.
Frightening.
These are some of the things that we have to fix, and fix quickly. We'll sign off for today and pollute this air no more, and see you tomorrow.
WBEN, Buffalo. Have you ever watched someone sit down to a meal and before the main course has arrived, they're stuffed themselves with bread? Well, many times they don't realize they're doing it. Here's a suggestion to keep guys like that, and maybe your husband is one of them, from spoiling their dinner with too much bread. Serve them crisp, light breadsticks instead, the kind Stella Doro bakes. Stella Doro breadsticks don't fill you up like bread, yet there's something very satisfying about them. Stella Doro bakes many different kinds of breadsticks, the regular, the dietetic, that's without salt, onion-flavored, and sesame. They cost very little, and they add so much to a meal, particularly when you're serving something Italian or with soups and salads. Look for Stella Doro breadsticks, along with all the other nice light things that Stella Doro bakes, the next time you're in the store. There's definitely a place in your day for Stella Doro.